Many years ago, in the German countryside, a family had been haunted by an unknown presence. For weeks, members of the family complained about strange noises coming from the attic and footsteps leading from the edge of the woods to the corner of their property. And then one day, the family vanished. After a week of them missing from school and church, members of the community went to investigate. It was there that they found the family massacred in their own home. Quite hauntingly, it seems that whoever the killer was lived among the bodies for several days to follow. And to this day remains one of the most terrifying unsolved cases in criminal history. Hello, everybody. Today we are going to be talking about the unsolved Hinterkaifeck massacre. Now, if you're familiar with true crime or unsolved murder cases, then this probably isn't anything new. The Hinterkaifeck massacre is one of the most famous unsolved murders that I've ever heard of. However, what I want to throw my hat in the ring on isn't only some new information I came across that I haven't heard mentioned on YouTube that often, but to also pose my theory for what I think might have happened. And I'll go ahead and get spoilers out of the way. It's not like I have any new information that I think is 100% going to open and shut the case, but I think some suspects are more likely than others. Credit where it's due, the book The Hinterkaifeck Murders, Terror in the German Countryside by D.A. Chadwick is a fantastic resource for a lot of the investigation that took place right after, as well as the interrogations that took place. And it does a great job at laying out the theories and suspect list of the case. Also, hinterkaifeck.net is a great place to see diagrams and images from the murders, which a big viewer discretion advised if you decide to go looking for that. I will be showing blurred images of the crime scene here, but nothing brutal because, out of respect for the departed, I feel like I probably shouldn't do that. But with that being said, I will be describing a lot of the tragic things that happened to this family, including the young children, so viewer discretion advised. So if you're interested, stick around after the ad as we talk about the terrible, unsolved mystery the Hinterkaifeck Massacre.
It's the new year, and with the new year comes a lot of ideas about how we can improve ourselves. Over the past several months, I've been taking my health more seriously, and that is something I plan to continue to do into 2025. And a part of that health plan is today's sponsor, AG1. AG1 is your daily morning health drink that contains things like a multivitamin, a phytonutrient blend, and probiotics all in one scoop. Based on the links of YouTube videos you people watch, I would imagine that fast food or delivery is a part of your daily diet. And I'm not one to throw stones, it's a part of mine too. And while that can be fun, it's not exactly good for you. But that's where AG1 is here to help. With 8 to 12 ounces of water and just a spoonful of AG1, you can start getting in on all the things your body is missing out on. One of the biggest things I noticed about AG1 is the energy I have throughout the day. Whereas I used to get tired after lunch or rely on caffeine to get me through my day, I'm now wide awake for as many hours as I'm awake. Because it's amazing how much better your body does when it gets the things that it needs. And to be clear, I'm not saying that I drank AG1 and then I lost a bunch of weight and started being more productive, but I am saying that AG1 certainly helped give me the natural energy to get things like that done. AG1 tastes great and is a part of my morning routine that I don't dread like taking a bunch of different pills and vitamins every day. From your energy to your gut health to your immune support, AG1 is an easy way to make 2025 a little bit better than 2024. And if you're interested on starting your year on the right foot, then there's never been a better time to get in on this offer. That's because right now, if you head to the link in the description at drinkag1.com/wendigoon or scan the QR code, you'll be able to get $20 off your first subscription to AG1. That is right, $20 off. On top of that, you get things like a free welcome kit with a shaker bottle, bottle of vitamin D3 and K2, and some travel packs of AG1. So once again, scan the QR code or head to drinkag1.com/wendigoon to get in on this incredible offer today. Thank you all for watching the ad. Thank you to AG1 for sponsoring the channel. As always, it means the most. Hope you all check them out. Link is in the description, and we are back to the video.
We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. The Hinterkaifeck property was called that because it was behind the small community of Kaifeck in Germany. The small farm here was made up of members of the Gruber family. And to make this story make sense, let's go ahead and break down the actual family members, as there are some repeating names and it can get confusing. And to do that, we're going to do it in the only way I know how. The owner of the Hinterkaifeck farm was a woman named Cecilia, whose family came to own the farm in the 1860s. However, shortly thereafter, her husband died. After this, she was approached by a former servant named Andreas Gruber, who married her, and the two of them had a daughter named Victoria. Also, I see the spellings for these names go back and forth. Sometimes it's Victoria with a K, sometimes it's Victoria with a C, sometimes it's Cecilia, other times it's Cecilia with a Z. I think it just depends on what language is translating the story, but you'll see it go back and forth. Victoria was born in the 1880s and grew up on the property with her family. At some point, ownership of the farm was transferred over to her. Not long before World War I, Victoria met a man named Carl Gabriel. The two of them became married and had a daughter named Cecilia that Victoria named after her mother. However, in the first year of fighting, Carl would die in World War I, leaving Victoria a widow. It was not long after this, in 1920, that Victoria would give birth to another child, a son named Joseph. Now, Victoria was not married, and the question of who the father of Joseph was is going to become a very important element of this story, especially when we theorize about who the suspect might be. Two people who also lived at the Hinterkaifeck farm but weren't related to the family were the two maids, Crescens Reiger and Maria Baumgartner. Crescens lived with the family for about a year before the massacre happened, but was not on the property during the night of the murder. Because of this, during the investigation, Crescens was interviewed a lot. On the contrary, Maria Baumgartner was there on the night of the murder, and as a matter of fact, tragically, it was her first day on the job. I should also mention that when our story takes place, at the end of March 1922, Cecilia was 7 years old and Joseph was two. Leading up to the family's untimely demise, a lot of weird stuff was happening around the farm in the early months of 1922. According to the things that the Gruber family would say to neighbors, it seemed that someone had been stalking them. The family reported seeing people standing on the edge of the tree line, just watching them before fading off into the woods. Now, it is true that on either side of the farm, there were footpaths that people would frequent to and from different towns. But even because that gives excuse as to why someone would be over there, it doesn't give excuse to why they would just stand there and look at you for a while before moving away as soon as you see them. On top of that, Andreas Gruber said that he had lost a key to the front door of the house, which he couldn't find. This key will come in later. According to a neighbor named Loren Schlittenbauer, who will become a major player in the story moving forward, on March the 30th, Andreas came to him and said that he found a set of footprints that tracked from the snow at the woods on the edge of the property to the motor shed that connected to the Gruber barn. Not only that, but he found the door to the motor shed thrown open. The Gruber family, like a lot of other families that farmed in the 1920s, had a motor that was connected to the barn in order to mechanize a lot of the things within the barn. However, this actual room that housed the motor did not have a connection to the barn itself, other than the small holes that the motor itself was ran through. In other words, whoever was able to throw open the door to the motor shed was not able to get access to the rest of the barn. So Gruber and Loren supposed that whoever did try to break into the barn wasn't able to, as there was no access from the motor shed. However, the more troubling detail is that Andrea said the set of footprints led to the barn, but he couldn't find any going away from the barn. Andreas conducted a sweep of the barn and the house and wasn't able to find anyone, but the detail remained odd. Furthermore, on the evening of March the 30th, Victoria and her father Andreas went out to town to buy supplies. While at a store, Victoria remarked that in the nights prior, the family had heard something moving around in the attic. Andreas investigated with a lantern and a shotgun, but didn't find anything. Regardless, this detail seems to have had Victoria spooked, as she is now relaying it to someone she met out in town. It was also during this trip to town that Andreas told local stories of things like the missing key, as well as a story that he found a newspaper from Munich in the woods near his house. But after he asked the mailman if anyone nearby subscribed to it, the mailman said they didn't, and he didn't deliver that paper. So it's very plain that Andreas was suspicious, but for reasons we'll talk about later, he never took this to the police. Now, it was not new information that the Hinterkaifeck property was weird. As a matter of fact, their maid, Crescens Reiger, knew this all too well. During Crescens' entire time working with the family, she was freaked out. Crescens lived at the property for only a year and was subjected to all kinds of mental torment. She said she would often hear something stamping around in the attic, or would wake up in the middle of the night to see something jiggling her doorknob. Just a few months prior to March, Crescens had given birth to a young child and decided that she no longer wanted to stay at a farm she believed to be haunted or something similar. So Crescens and her young daughter left in early 1922. So the family began looking for a new maid, and eventually a woman named Maria Baumgartner was hired. One day after Victoria and Andreas' trip to town, on March the 31st, Maria was dropped off by her sister at the Hinterkaifeck farm. Maria's sister said hello to the family and goodbye to Maria, and left late that evening, and was the last one to see any member of the family alive. That night, something would happen that would become the subject of mystery for over a century to come. The first sign that something might be wrong came the next day, on April the 1st, when Victoria's daughter Cecilia was not present at school. However, Cecilia was described as a child that got sick a lot, and when she was sick, she would stay home from school, so no one thought anything of it. That same day, two men who delivered coffee to farms around town stopped by the household. It was normal for the Gruber family to receive their deliveries on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and given that it was a Friday, the coffee salesman arrived at the Gruber household in order to take their order and drop off their coffee. However, according to the two men, they made their way to the property, knocked on the door, didn't get an answer, peered in the windows and didn't see anything, and then left. Later that night, a witness who was walking to Groburn, a small town only 500 meters away from the Heinterkaifeck farm, said that he saw smoke coming from the chimney outside. The witness said that he smelled what he would describe as dirty rags, and as he was peering towards the farm, a man holding a lantern walked up to him, the light being so bright in the middle of the darkness that it blinded the witness, who put his head down and continued on his path. Over the following weekend, no one at church saw the family either, which was especially suspicious considering that Victoria was known to be faithful to her local church. However, it would be on April the 4th that the horrors of what had happened at the property would be revealed. Once again, little Cecilia did not arrive at school, but the more suspicious finding was what happened with Albert Hoffner. Albert Hoffner was a repairman from a town nearby who had come to the Heinterkaifeck farm to repair the aforementioned engine that was inside the engine room. Albert gets to the property around 9 a.m. and after knocking on the doors and hanging around the windows, doesn't see anyone. Other than the dog that is tied up near the front door, it seems that the property is completely dead. But given that the dog is tied up near the front door, Albert thinks that maybe the family is out for the day and tied the dog up as a form of security until they got back. So Albert gives it an hour, hangs out near the property waiting for someone to show up, and when they eventually don't, Albert decides to get to work by prying the lock off of the engine shed door. He fixes the engine for the next several hours and leaves the property around 2:30. Since he wasn't able to inform any member of the family that he had fixed the shed, he goes to the neighboring property and sees two girls who are outside taking care of the garden. These girls are Mary and Victoria Schlittenbauer, the daughters of the aforementioned Lorenz Schlittenbauer. Albert tells Mary and Victoria that he just got done fixing the motor, if one of them could inform the family whenever the family gets back. So Mary and Victoria go to their father Lorenz and tell him what Albert told them. Lorenz sends two of his sons over to the property next door to let the family know, but after a little bit, the sons come back and say that they couldn't find anyone either. It seems at this point that Lorenz got suspicious, because again, the family wasn't seen at church, and it's uncharacteristic for these people who work on their own farm to be gone for 4 days on end. Not to mention that when Lorenz's sons got back, they said that all of the animals were very rowdy and upset. So Lorenz gets two other neighbors, Jacob Sigel and Michael Pohl, to come with him to search the farm. The three men make it to the property and walk to the open feeding area that can be accessed from the front courtyard. From there, the three men decide to make it into the barn that connects to the house that is being barred by a wooden block on the other side. The three men use force to break through the door and begin to search inside of the barn itself. While walking around in the barn, one of the men feels something at their foot before they look down to see a human hand. The men quickly sweep away the hay to reveal the body of Victoria Gabriel. At that moment, they see another body behind Victoria and begin to pull it out to realize that it is the body of Andreas Gruber. It becomes apparent quickly to the men that the body of four family members is located through the barn, meaning Andreas, Victoria, both Cecilia the grandmother and Cecilia the granddaughter, all lying dead under the hay. Immediately, Jacob and Michael make their way back to the courtyard as Lorenz sprints into the house. Lorenz would later say that he did this in order to check on the two-year-old Joseph. However, when Lorenz made it into the house, he saw that Joseph had also been murdered inside of his stroller. Lorenz unlocked the front door to the house and the two other men stepped inside. They investigated through the rest of the house to see if anyone was still there and found the body of Maria Baumgartner dead on the floor of her room. But given that Maria had just got there on March the 31st, the night that the murders happened, none of the men knew who she was. The men came outside where Lorenz's two aforementioned sons were waiting. Lorenz told the two boys to run to the nearby town and tell the mayor and police while they stayed at the crime scene. Along the way, these young boys, as you can imagine, told everyone that they passed what had happened at the farm. So word spread around fast, and very quickly, the Heinterkaifeck farm became a circus. By the time the police got there, which was only a few hours later, there were all kinds of people walking through the different rooms of the house, inspecting the dead bodies, giving their opinion, and, of course, destroying evidence. Not on purpose, of course. People just, you know, stomping around a crime scene doesn't really help a crime scene. After the police get there, they order everyone to leave except Lorenz, who gives an account of how they found everyone. And from there, they are able to piece together what might have happened on the night of March the 31st. And to show you that, I'm going to show you with the same stupid little whiteboard that I did earlier. So this is a basic layout of the house to give you an idea of what it looked like during the murder and investigation. Outside of the house was a large courtyard, and the house itself was split into three different structures. Over here you had the main house or living quarters where things like the bedrooms and kitchen were. This entire section was the barn, with a lot of the animal stalls being in this area and a lot of the hay and area for feeding or taking care of the animals being over here. And then this area is described in a lot of the reports as a machinery or work area, which to me sounds like the 1920s equivalent of a garage, where, you know, you work on tractors or whatever, so I'm calling it a garage. Also connected to the side of the barn, but with no way to get into the barn itself, was the motor room that I mentioned earlier, where the repairman came and did his work, and where the footprints leading to it, as well as the broken door, were found by Andreas earlier. When Lorenz, Michael, and Jacob arrived, the three of them saw that the doorway that led to the garage area of the building was wide open. After the men stepped in here, they elected to push open this door that was held shut and make their way into the barn itself. It was while in here that they would find the bodies of Victoria, Andreas, grandmother Cecilia, and granddaughter Cecilia, dead, hidden under the hay. From here, as mentioned earlier, Lorenz made his way through the main section of the house, again according to him, in order to check on young Joseph. As he did this, the two others made their way back out to the courtyard to get to the front door. It was here that Lorenz found the body of 2-year-old Joseph, murdered in his stroller or bassinet in Victoria's room. And then, after the other two came in, they discovered the body of Baumgartner in her new quarters, the maid's quarters, at the back of the house. From here, the three men came outside, Lorenz sent his sons to go tell the local police, and from here, everyone started to come to the house to see the murder scene. Couple other things to mention. This is Victoria's room, as I said, and this is Andreas and grandmother Cecilia's room over here. And then this room seems to be the dining room where a lot of the interviews took place. Another thing to mention, because this is going to come up a lot in the investigation, there was an attic that ran through some parts of the house and at least led to a sort of hayloft over the entirety of the garage and barn area. It seems that the way to get up there was at this staircase right as you are leaving the house segment of the property and working your way into the barn part of the property. So it seemed that the only way to access the attic was through this staircase in the main house. That, and there is a ladder mentioned somewhere in the police reports, either being on like the outside of the building or in the garage area. But either way, it seems that the most common way to get to the second floor or hidden area of the house is through the staircase. That will matter as we get into the details of the investigation. Also, crucially, whenever Lorenz ran through the house and then opened this front door, he had to unlock it in order to open it. That, in combination with this door being barred shut and there being no other means of access out of the house unless you, you know, broke a window, that means whoever was in the house effectively locked themselves in unless they make their way down from the attic, which we'll talk about that more, and how there was potentially a rope used for a descent either here or over here. Again, the police notes on this weren't great, given that it was 1922 and none of the departments were really talking to each other. Now, one of the reasons that the Hinterkaifeck murder sticks out so much in my mind, and one of the reasons that I find it so terrifying, is because, according to investigators, of the way that these murders played out. There were spots of blood underneath the hay and, of course, where the bodies had been left in the barn. But according to investigators, there were no other spots of blood in the rest of the house, save for the area where Maria was killed and young Joseph was killed. And all people who were murdered, except for the grandmother Cecilia, were wearing their nightgowns and sleeping clothes, or basically their pajamas. Maybe grandmother Cecilia did it because she was staying up late to get work done around the house, but it seemed that everyone else was ready to go to bed when the murders took place. What that means likely happened, and again, given that there was no blood through the rest of the house or down this hallway, is that whoever murdered these people waited in the barn and one by one had them step into the barn where they were murdered, dragged out of the doorway, and the killer awaited his next victim. I often find myself thinking what, if anything, the killer had to do to lead the family members out one by one. Maybe one of them simply walked into the barn in order to do their nightly chores with the animals before they were killed, and then the following family members came to look. Maybe young Cecilia came to look for her mother. And how terrifying that is to imagine that while alone in your house, ready to go to bed, there is someone waiting in another part of it, ready to kill you. This theory of waiting to kill the family members also makes sense given the other two murders, because it's not like Joseph could make his way to the barn to see what the rest of his family was doing at only 2 years old. And if the killer had been watching the family for a while, well, they didn't have a maid for 2 months, and Maria had gotten there early that day, which probably meant the killer thought that he or they had killed everyone in the house after they killed these four, only to make their way into the house and see that there is a new maid that they decided to murder as well. And as mentioned, after these killings were complete, it seems that the killer stuck around with the bodies for a day or so. How monstrous to turn a house full of life into one full of just your own. The story went on to become infamous, especially in Germany, and worked its way into a lot of urban legends. Several stories of werewolves or witches that murdered these people came to mind. And yeah, after seeing the brutality of this, who could blame them? So following this, police began their investigation. And investigation standards in 1922 were not what they are today. For one, the police made their headquarters at the Hinterkaifeck farm, and they interviewed everyone or interrogated everyone at the dining room table. On April the 6th, a couple of days after the bodies were found, the coroner came and performed his autopsy in the barn on a makeshift table next to where they were murdered, or at least where the bodies were found. And after the autopsies were performed, all six heads were removed and sent to a clairvoyant to see if they could psychically tell anything from the heads. After that, the heads were kept in a nearby city as a part of evidence if a trial was to ever come of the murders. But it seems that the heads, along with a lot of the other documented evidence of what happened, were destroyed in 1944 during Allied bombings of Germany. That's another thing, because Germany went through a war just a couple of decades after this happened, a lot of the records have been lost to time. Without going into too much detail, or at least more than what's required, again, viewer discretion, this was the finding of the autopsy reports. Andreas had been severely hit across the face with such ferocity that part of his cheekbone was exposed, and it seems that the reason he died is because his carotid artery was injured and he bled out. Regardless of this, it seems that Andreas was only hit a single time, which cannot be said for most of the other victims. To start, it seems that Andreas's wife, Cecilia, had been strangled before the same heavy object that was used to hit Andreas was used to strike her across the face several times. Similarly, Victoria was also struck with a high level of ferocity, along with the series of blows across her face, which left her horribly disfigured. It seems that there were several puncture wounds into her skull. And then the youngest daughter, Cecilia, who again was only 7 years old at the time, was not only struck by the same heavy object several times, but was also cut across her throat. And the autopsy determined that she was seemingly alive for several hours following as she bled out and, again, according to the autopsy, pulled out clumps of her own hair. And as haunting and terrible as it is to mention, it seemed that Cecilia was in a state of undress consistent with someone attempting to assault her in her final moments. The new maid, Miss Baumgartner, was found laying on the floor in her bedroom and had been struck across the face back and forth several times, again by the same heavy-handed weapon. And then the two-year-old Joseph was found in his stroller, as it seemed the perpetrator raised the heavy weapon and then brought it down through the top of the stroller, killing Joseph in a single blow to the head. Initially, it was believed that the weapon that was most likely used was a pickaxe, because the weight and type of injury seemed consistent with that sort of weapon. It would later be determined that in actuality, a mattock was used, but we'll talk about that in a moment. Now, during the initial investigation, the police found several patches of hay up in the hayloft that seemed to be padded down. In other words, it seems that someone was sleeping on the hay since the hay had been moved. In other words, between the time someone fed the animals and now, someone slept on the hay. Furthermore, it seemed that someone had defecated in the hayloft and had moved tiles around in the floor of the hayloft in order to see the ground beneath them. This in combination with pieces of food found around the premises, as well as the report mentioned earlier that someone was running a stove on the night of April 1st, implies that after murdering the family, someone stayed there with them. Now, there are a few reasons this could be. For one, on the night of March the 31st, a huge blizzard hit, leading investigators to believe that perhaps whoever snuck into the house to kill the family was trapped by the snow and had to wait for it to melt. It's also worth mentioning that there seemed to be a lot of holes in the police's investigation. Like, even aside from mentioning all of the lack of care when it came to the evidence, there are some other details that seem to be just wrong. For example, yes, it does seem that whoever killed the family stayed in the house because of things like the defecation in the hayloft and the hay being laid down, and there was some food found in the hayloft. But one of the police's main points for this is that a lot of food was missing from the food storage of the Gruber family, when in reality, it seems that a lot of that was Lorenz's fault. See, while people were staying there, and while police were staying there initially, and a bunch of people were coming to look, I guess in order to be kind, Lorenz just kind of started handing food out to people. And even though the police seemed to be aware of this and even accepted some of the food, which again, tampering of a crime scene, but whatever, even though the police knew this, they logged the missing food as evidence that a lot of people probably killed the family and were here for a really long time. Furthermore, on April the 6th, again, 2 days after the bodies were found and the same day the autopsy was performed, the police make the first mention of a rope that leads down from the hayloft to the ground floor. More specifically, the kind of attic area that's hidden away from the open hayloft that would be harder to see if you were walking around on the ground. So, in other words, there was a dangling rope in front of them for 2 days, and then one day they go, oh, there's a rope here. Someone write that down. Either they just didn't think to mention it or didn't notice it for a couple of days, or with all of the people poking around the house, someone crawled up to the attic and pushed the rope out. Either way, it seems that there was a rope that led from the attic to the ground floor, meaning that there might have been another way for someone to get to the hayloft of the barn to the ground floor without going on the ladder that was on the outside of the building, or in other words, exposed to prying eyes. A lot of their investigation was kind of like subjective too. Like, for example, at one point they were trying to determine if someone could hear a scream from the barn from inside of the living room. So one of them just went to the barn and yelled, and then all the guys inside said, nope, we didn't hear that. So they just wrote down that it was unlikely that someone from the barn screamed or called out to get other people to come in there. And it's like, okay, but like, how loud did the guy scream? Or like, were you listening that hard? Were you talking to someone else when he screamed? Like, that's not how we do experiments, but whatever. From the several interrogations and interviews that the police performed in the dining room of the Heiter Kaifek farm, the story of the farm itself came to light, as tragic as it was. The most apparent thing that came out of these interviews is that the Gruber family was not a good one. The majority of people around town just had stories about the family being generally unpolite or kind of kept to themselves and didn't talk to a lot of neighbors. But those who knew the family had much darker stories about them. For one, Victoria was the only daughter of Andreas and Cecilia. But according to those, she was just the only one that survived. Several accounts, including that of Carl Gabriel, again, he is the guy that was married to Victoria for a time, had stated that the Grubers had more children, at least one known of, a girl named Sophie, but that when the children misbehaved, they would go long periods of time without eating and were often locked in a cellar for days on end, and that many of the children died of malnutrition and disease. Victoria was just the one that lived. To clarify, Carl Gabriel had told people of this before he went to World War I. He did not give a testimony to the police 4 years after his death from beyond the grave. And if it wasn't bad enough that Victoria was the family's only surviving daughter, Andreas would frequently have sexual relations with her. In 1915, Andreas served a short stint in jail for incest. This is also the reason that, despite Andreas's suspicions, he never brought anything to the police, because he already had bad interactions with the police after being arrested for incest. And a few years later would have another charge put against him for incest by Lorenz Schlittenbauer, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Lorenz told police that Victoria told him since she was 16 years old, her father began having relations with her and had tried even earlier. So much so that it was widely believed throughout the town and officially known for a while that the 2-year-old Joseph was actually the child of Victoria and her father, Andreas. This was just a known fact throughout the town, and as you could imagine, a lot of people hated the Gruber family because of it. Or at the very least, they hated Andreas. Even if a lot of people just knew this to be a rumor, what they did know about the family is that they were said to have a lot of money. And this makes sense, as they seemingly had a large farm, and Cecilia's family came from money. But the Grubers, at least outwardly, were very stingy. They would pay workers what they were owed, but not a drop more. And if they did provide food for people, it was always the bare minimum. This was actually something stated by Carl Gabriel. After Carl married Victoria, it seems that he was immediately in over his head. He told his family stories of things like the Grubers having several children that died in the cellar. And he found out that his new wife had previously been forced into relations by her father, and that the family overall was generally unfriendly, had bad food, and were horrible to be around. As a matter of fact, just before the war, Carl had already been talking about divorce. So it was always said throughout the town that there was a ton of money hidden at the Heidenkaifeck farm. And this led police to what they believed to be the motivation for the killing: money. And on the surface, that makes a lot of sense, right? You have this stingy family in town that no one cares about, and they're said to have a lot of money on the property. So anyone would have to do is break into the house, steal the money, and they're home free. And perhaps they ran into members of the family when this happened and could leave no witnesses. However, there's still a few holes with this idea. For one, and again, this is an unsolved murder, but spoilers, I guess, a year after this, there were no charges and no one was convicted of it, so the farm passed off to family members who would demolish the property. In the demolishing, they found in the attic of the house a mattock handle that was covered in human hair and blood and determined to be the murder weapon. It was a mattock handle that Andreas had and had kept in his barn. He had kind of modified it to be like a club that would be used in trench fighting during World War I. So does that mean that people broke into the house to steal money but didn't bring a weapon, but when they found a weapon in the barn, were then determined to kill everyone in the house? Also, the ferocity of the murders doesn't exactly seem like someone who's just covering up evidence. Sure, maybe on Andreas's part because he was just struck once, but the women were ferociously attacked. And of course, needless to say, if your concern is getting rid of witnesses, then why on earth would you kill a 2-year-old child? But perhaps most importantly, to poke a hole in this theory, money wasn't missing. Sure, it's estimated that around 100,000 marks were missing from Victoria's personal stash, but throughout the rest of the house, they found things like gold and expensive jewelry and silver coins. You know, the kind of thing if you just murdered an entire family, you would probably take the time to pick up. While a bunch of Victoria's belongings were lying on her bed as if someone was going through them for some reason, you would think someone that is there to murder a family and then hang out for a few days would check a jewelry drawer. So police kind of reframed their thinking. Maybe then it was just a serial killer. And sure, this does kind of make sense, especially with the more demented details of the case, like killing a child or sticking around the dead bodies for at least a day afterwards. And there's a lot of people to this day who espouse this as their primary theory. They'll connect it to other serial killers in the region or other, like, spree killings that were happening during this time. The book The Man from the Train asserts that an American serial killer by the name of Paul Mueller, who disappeared around 1912, may have traveled to Europe and committed this massacre, as a lot of the killings he is suspected to be tied to have similarities with the Heidenkaifeck massacre. But even with the serial killer angle, there are still some problems that arise out of that theory. For example, why stick around? Sure, maybe stick around the night you committed the murders, because as mentioned, there was a blizzard outside. But why stick around to eat food and sleep in the hayloft, or burn something in the oven, according to the one witness? For one, despite all of this believing to have happened on the night of March the 31st, which is indicated by a lot of things like Cecilia missing school the next day, and Maria being found dead in her bed that she had just arrived to with her bag still unpacked, and everyone being found dead in their nightclothes, despite it being clear this happened on March the 31st, the calendar in the kitchen was flipped to April the 1st. On top of that, after the mailman delivered mail to the address on April the 1st, by April the 4th, someone had moved it to the inside window of the living room, which was the place that Andreas would always stash the newspaper. Furthermore, and this is kind of murky because documentation of this wasn't perfect, but it seems that between April the 1st and April the 4th, someone had moved the dog from a post tied out like further away from the house to right at the front door, which again is what the family would do whenever they were out from the house for the day. So it seems that whoever was around the house after the murders took place was familiar with the Gruber's habits. Another detail that isn't confirmed but is rumored is that in the corner of the barn, there was about a shovel deep trench that was attempted to be dug out, as if someone was starting to dig a hole in the barn before deciding to instead put the bodies underneath the hay. So why would a random serial killer change the calendar date, put the newspaper on the inside of the window, move the dog around, and then attempt to bury the bodies in a property they have no connection to? Because sure, you want as much time between the police finding the bodies and you having a chance to get as far away as possible, I get that. But if you're so concerned about delaying the time until the bodies are found, why stick around? Sure, the whole someone stayed with the body for 4 days is thrown again because of the police logging all the missing food that they ate, and considering that to be a group of people who stuck around the bodies for too long. But it seems that whoever was there was around for at least a day or two. Another thing that happened with the Heinter Kaifeck case is it became the story to be talked about. People, during the investigation, were literally taking trains from towns outside of the area to come visit the murder site and just gawk and point at the place where the body used to be, I guess. Because of that, it seems that the police had a lot of leads, but they weren't all good leads. For one, every homeless person in the region immediately became a suspect, because since the police said a vagrant might be responsible, a lot of people just started making up stories about, oh, I was out in town, and then someone ran by and said they killed the whole family, and then they ran off into the woods or something. There was a woman in the 1940s who went to a priest and wrote on a piece of paper that her brothers are responsible for the killings, and then on her deathbed again said that they were responsible for the killings. Those brothers were Anton and Adolf Gump. Adolf Gump is an insane name. But the police interviewed the brothers, and it seems one was dead and the other one had zero connection and had never been in the region. There were a few cases like that of people randomly saying someone they know was the murderers because they told them one time under a certain circumstance, but every single suspect that they looked into had an alibi or wasn't in the area at the time. There are even some people who were temporarily jailed over such suspicions, but no one was ever charged for the murders. As mentioned, a year later, possession of the property would pass on to family members of the Grubers who decided to destroy the farm because, you know, who would want to live there? And it was during the destruction of the property that the mattock I mentioned earlier was found, as well as a small pocket knife, both of which seemed to be hidden in the attic above the house itself, the pocket knife seemingly being what was used on young Cecilia. So whoever killed them, after having killed everyone, threw the murder weapons up into the attic of the house. Which again, if it was just a random passerby, why would they leave the evidence with their fingerprints on it? Which fingerprints were a thing at the time. Why would, I mean, you wouldn't think so with this case with everyone touching everything, but still. Why would someone who was just passing through to murder a family leave the murder weapon on the murder site? As mentioned, nothing conclusive would ever come from the case, but there are certainly some theories. For one, it seemed that Victoria knew something was up. 2 weeks prior to the murder, she had placed 700 gold marks in the church confessional. The priest found 700 gold marks in the confessional and knew that Victoria was the only member of the church who was well off enough to do that, and after asking her, she admitted that it was her. Not only that, but in the weeks leading up to the case, she had closed several savings accounts and bank accounts after withdrawing the cash. This is why it's believed that 100,000 marks were stolen from Victoria's personal inventory at the house, because despite taking all of this money out, it seems that she never spent it anywhere and no one could ever find it. I guess it is possible that someone who knew she had withdrawn all of this money came to the house to kill everyone and take it, but why would you take, like, the one stack of cash you know about and not grab all the other stacks of gold throughout the house? Again, the family seemed to be rather well off, and the farm was in Victoria's name. On top of that, one of 7-year-old Cecilia's classmates would be interviewed years later. This classmate said that on March the 30th, again the day before the murders, Cecilia came to school very tired. Cecilia told her friend that the night before, her grandfather, Andreas, slapped Victoria, Cecilia's mom, and that Victoria ran away from the house crying into the woods, and that the family was out all night looking for her, only finding her in the early hours of the morning. So, a couple days before the murder, Victoria was in such dire straits with her father that she ran away from the house in the middle of the cold winter night. Or maybe March 30th isn't technically winter. It was cold outside. It's for these reasons that most of the theories around what happened at the Hinterkaifeck massacre revolve around Victoria. And I, for one, think that it makes the most sense. For one, she was the only member of the family who ever really got out of the house and interacted with people. And also, she seemed to be the only one that was doing anything suspicious before the murders happened. With that being said, there are three primary suspects that get talked about in relation to this case. Again, if you put aside the ones that are saying this is a sort of serial killing or a robbery gone wrong that just by coincidence happened to this family. But given some of the circumstantial evidence that I talked about earlier, I think that it is more likely that whoever murdered this family knew them, and that this killing was very personal. The first suspect that got talked about a lot when all of this happened is also the fun one. And that suspect is Carl Gabriel. That is right, Victoria's husband, who supposedly died in the trenches during World War I. It was not uncommon at the time for soldiers to be reported dead and then just show up back home. I mean, think about it. You have these massive, like, charges across trench lines or chemical weapon attacks, and seemingly entire battalions get wiped out at once. Well, the soldiers there would be presumed dead, but if they were actually alive, they have no way to communicate that to their family until they just catch a train and ride home. So the theory floating around town for a time, again, it was a known fact that Andreas was having relations with his daughter, and that supposedly that's where the two-year-old child came from. The theory that was floating around is that Carl returned from the war having been presumed dead and was furious to find that Victoria had had a child. So in a fit of rage, Carl picked up a mattock and killed his former wife, as well as the rest of her family, and his own daughter, as well as the illegitimate child of his former wife and her father. Now, even if we play with the whole theory that Carl survived the war, this seems kind of implausible. For one, as mentioned, Carl was already talking about divorcing Victoria before he shipped out to the war. So then why, after several years, would he decide he was so angry about her current situation that he has to kill her? As well as, and I can't stress this enough, his own 7-year-old daughter. Also, there have never been any records of him surviving or him showing up in town afterwards. So did he just walk from the front line to his house to kill his family and then just walk somewhere else? One of the main reasons that this theory gets talked about so much is during World War II, the theory made a resurgence. A German soldier had claimed that he was held captive by Russian soldiers where he met Carl Gabriel, who was now a Russian commander. The German soldier told this whole story that while he was a prisoner of war, there was a Russian commander who spoke fluent German and sounded like he was from the area. And then after realizing the prisoner was from the area, the commander asked if he knew of the Hinterkaifeck murders, and the prisoner said yes, and the commander said, "I am the one who committed the Hinterkaifeck murders." And that he explained himself to be Carl Gabriel, and then let this German soldier, as well as two other German soldiers, go so that they could go back to the town and report this story so that an innocent man would not be charged for the murders. Now, there's some problems with this. For one, when the investigation was happening right after the murders, the police looked into the Carl Gabriel idea and got full confirmation from the German military that yes, he died in World War I. On top of that, according to the German prisoners, the reason he became a Russian commander is because he was so vicious and fierce that the Russians liked him and decided to make him a commander. But if there was one thing that the Russians really weren't fans of during World War II, it was, you know, Germans. And why would the guy who massacred his own wife, child, and family and was now supposedly a Russian commander because he was so evil and vicious or whatever, let these three go so that they could keep an innocent man from being tried for his crimes? Obviously, it sounds like a tall tale made up by some soldiers who wanted some publicity, right? But nevertheless, the Carl Gabriel theory comes up a lot whenever you read about this case. With that out of the way, there are two primary suspects who get talked about in this case more than anyone else. One of them is Loren Schlittenbauer. Now, a lot of you guys were probably listening to this whole story and saying to yourself over and over, oh, so Lorenz did it, right? Because he was the first one who showed up on the crime scene. He was the one who was accidentally messing with evidence. He was the one who knew the family. And perhaps most interestingly, he is the one who, officially at least, was the father of Joseph. So I need to rewind a little bit for this to make sense. While Lorenz had his problems with the Gruber family, he always had a fondness for Victoria. The two of them had talked to each other on a few occasions, and according to Lorenz, after just a few times of speaking to each other, Victoria offered to go to bed with him. Lorenz was taken back by this, as he was married at the time, and denied her offer, but a few years later, when Lorenz's wife died of cancer in 1918, him and Victoria seemed to start a relationship. One kind of heartbreaking note is Lorenz, as well as several of the men who were interviewed by police during this whole thing, made remarks that Victoria was easy and especially promiscuous and whatnot, which, given the amount of trauma that poor girl went through, is heartbreaking. I'll talk about more at the end, but I don't think there's anyone, except maybe the children, of course, that I feel as bad for in this case as Victoria. So Lorenz and Victoria had a relationship and began seeing each other on and off. At one point, Victoria even brings up the idea of marriage, and Lorenz agrees. However, it is then that Victoria tells him that she is pregnant. Again, all this is around 1919, 1920. Now, Lorenz knew, and it was common knowledge throughout the town, that Andreas had had incestuous relations with Victoria. And according to people like Crescens, the maid who quit earlier, even after Andreas had his stint in jail, it was not uncommon for him to abuse his own daughter. So Lorenz says that it might be my child that you're pregnant with, but it just might as well be your father's. And Lorenz decides that he will not claim the child and reports Andreas to the police again for incest. After Andreas is jailed, Victoria begs Lorenz to take responsibility for the child's paternity, both because it would be a better standing for Victoria in the public eye to have a child with someone that isn't her father, and it would also bode well for the child itself to not be known as the son of his grandfather. So Lorenz claims paternity, but then there becomes a whole fight between the family and Lorenz as far as child support goes, with the family saying that Victoria is owed this much and Lorenz saying she's not, and it goes back and forth for a while before Victoria eventually drops it. At one point, Lorenz brings up the idea to the family that he wants to marry Victoria, and initially the family is in approval of it, before one day, Andrea says no. Apparently, at one point, Lorenz had came to the family and said that he would marry her if Andreas stopped having incestuous relationships with her, and Andreas said something to the effect of, "We'll see." You know, Andreas really needed to get beat to death with a pickaxe, but it's a shame the rest of his family had to die as well. Based on some comments that Andreas made to people and his behavior, it seems that he didn't want anyone to have Victoria but him. Just a few days before the massacre, on March the 26th, one of Lorenz's youngest daughters would die of whooping cough. So, several people believe that just a few days later, perhaps he was fed up with this relationship with the Gruber family, decided to confront them, and a fight broke out that resulted in him massacring the family, including Andreas, who caused this trouble, and Victoria, who he may have saw as responsible for all of this, and killing the child that he saw as an illegitimate son of the woman he wanted to marry and the father who prevented it. And it is safe to say that a lot of Lorenz's behavior was suspicious. As mentioned, during the hours following the crime, there were way too many people there and they were touching way too much stuff. And Lorenz seemed to be encouraging this by handing out pieces of food and encouraging people to eat. And as the investigation was underway, Lorenz kind of acted like a tour guide, telling them what to think of other people in town, who they should interrogate, etc. And it was public knowledge that Lorenz had a lot of problems with the Gruber, so if all of them disappeared, that would be great for him. Lorenz was also incredibly knowledgeable about the case. He knew every detail by heart, and the whole detail about someone tried to dig a hole in the barn but were unable to and just covered the bodies in hay, that came from him. After the barn was demolished, he was speaking to an onlooker when he said the ground was too hard to dig, so they must have covered the bodies in hay. Not only that, but according to witnesses, years later in a pub when the topic of the Hinterkaifeck murders were being discussed, and someone asked why the footsteps worked one way through the snow to the house but not back out, Lorenz said, "I simply walk backwards through my own footprints in the snow." Now, he immediately clarified when asked about this that he was saying "I" in an as if I was the killer voice. But this, as well as several murmurings throughout the town that Lorenz, being an important town official and very well off, very well might have committed the crimes and then threatened other people to be silent, lest they get into some kind of legal trouble. As a matter of fact, one of the two men that Lorenz brought to the farm on the day of the murders would later say that they think Lorenz did it and brought them there as an alibi to say that he was the first one who showed up. I mean, remember the detail about whenever they get to the barn, Lorenz goes through the house and then unlocks the door? Well, he unlocked the door with a key. Remember how Andreas had said that a key went missing in the days before the murders? Well, seemingly, here that key is now, in the door. And whenever Lorenz was asked about it, he said the key was already there. Or perhaps Lorenz stole a key and was now placing it here in order to act natural and gain access to the house, as he did perhaps when the murders took place. Now, a lot of people think Lorenz did it, and a lot of things like what I mentioned point towards him. But personally, I do not. And I have a few reasons for this. For one of the reasons that Lorenz was ruled out by investigators when the case first happened is that Lorenz had horrific asthma. And asthma is really an understatement. Lorenz was in World War I and was exposed to chemical gas like mustard gas. So his lungs were effectively crippled and he lost his wind very quickly. Doesn't seem like the kind of person that would have the capability to murder a family of six. On top of that, yes, Lorenz knew a lot about the case, but he seemed to be more obsessed with the case than anyone else alive. Lorenz was there for every detail of it. Every time a bit of information was made public, he wanted to know it. According to his family, in the years following the massacre, Lorenz was destroyed by it. Not only did he seem to mourn the death of Victoria, at least in some part, but it destroyed his reputation. People around town would quit serving him. He wasn't allowed to do business with the other business owners. Everyone looked at him like a pariah. So it makes sense that someone whose life was so heavily affected by it would spend so much time thinking of the case. It would make sense that he would come to conclusions like, oh, well, the small patch of shovel-deep soil that was dug up was probably someone who tried to bury the bodies, but realized the ground was too hard. And then he just kind of spouts that information to whoever's willing to listen. Same with his assertion about the footprints leading to the barn. Also, that doesn't even make any sense. What would that even have to do? Are you saying that the killer made a set of footprints to the barn and then walked backwards through the footprints just to freak out the family and then made an entry at some other time? Like, that doesn't make sense. And also, as cheesy as it is to say, I think in some way that Lorenz cared about Victoria. Think about it. Not only had he agreed to marry her, but at this point he had taken responsibility for the child that very well might have not been his. He was willing to admit publicly to a court that he was the father of young Joseph, and he suffered the consequences for it. Lorenz said that his own son hated him for it. He hated that Lorenz, after the death of the son's mother, would sleep with another woman and have a child outside of his family. Not to mention the reproach that probably came from a small town when a well-to-do person takes acknowledgement of an illegitimate child. If the murders would have happened right after he said the child wasn't his, and Andreas was being convicted again for incest, then maybe the idea of Lorenz murdering the family would have a point. But Lorenz went through all of that and then still tried to marry Victoria and claimed the baby. Also, if Lorenz was to murder them, why was he so especially brutal to Cecilia the grandmother, Victoria, and Cecilia the 7-year-old child? I mean, why would he try to undress her and then just give Andreas a single hit to the face? I think what is much more likely is that the third suspect we're going to talk about today is the one that I personally believe probably murdered the family. And that man is, of course, Andreas Gruber. So, Andreas, as we've established, very evil person, with the ability to kill children if the beliefs of his children dying in the cellar are true. As we know, Lorenz was wanting to marry Victoria, and it seemed that Andreas wanted nothing to do with that. But in the weeks leading up to the massacre, it seemed that Victoria was withdrawing a lot of money. Maybe Victoria had some plans to run over to Lorenz's property and live with him. Maybe after the death of Lorenz's daughter, he tried to push her to do it quicker. Maybe that's why, according to the young Cecilia, on the night of March the 29th and morning of March the 30th, Andreas had hit Victoria, causing her to run into the woods. Maybe they have had a fight about Victoria and Lorenz being together. I mean, think about it. The murder weapon that was used on the family was the mattock that Andreas had constructed. So perhaps Victoria begins fighting him about it one night, and Andreas hits her and then doesn't quit hitting her. And then maybe because Victoria was out in the barn for too long, Cecilia came to check, and then Cecilia, her daughter, came to check, and Andreas murdered them one by one. And sadly, due to the young Cecilia's state of undress, I do know one person in this story who is willing to abuse their own daughter in that way, or their own granddaughter in that case. And then, of course, from there, he's already on a rampage and can't leave any witnesses, so he murders Baumgartner, who had just arrived earlier that night, and then, of course, murders the child that he feels is responsible for all this turmoil in the first place. This would explain a lot of things. This would explain why the newspaper was placed up in the window. This would explain why the calendar was flipped over to April the 1st. This would explain why the mattock and the pocket knife were thrown into the attic. It was the only place within his own home that Andreas could think to hide the weapons. Perhaps then, for the next couple days, not knowing what to do because he didn't have a plan to begin with, Andreas hides in the roof of the hayloft and the attic and watches people come to visit the house before they leave. This would explain the sleeping on the hay. This would explain defecating in the hayloft and the food that was eaten. It would also explain the casual attempt to dig a mass grave before just hiding the bodies in the hay. Heck, if you think Andreas's murder is premeditated, this even explains him going to a store the day before, saying he's seen weird people around the house, saying he's seen footsteps, saying that a key has gone missing. I mean, if Lorenz was right about the key being in the front door, then perhaps the key was never lost in the first place. Perhaps Andreas, after he had murdered everyone, locked every entry to the house, because, again, the doorway into the barn was barred by a wooden block as well. Perhaps he locked every entry into the house and then went up to the attic, where the only way back down from there was through the rope that the police would mention on April the 6th. Perhaps Andreas just panicked and decided he was going to wait in there until something happened. The police even mentioned that despite the amount of trauma to the victims' faces, there was no spot where it looks like blood was pooled or a definitive spot where the murder happened. So maybe Andreas, in a panic, even tried to clean up some of the blood and then burn the rags, which would explain the smell of dirty rags as the witness described. Maybe Andreas, trying to get someone away from the property, was the one who walked out and held the lantern up to the witness's face. I believe all of that, and frankly, to me, this is the version of the story that makes the most sense. This explains why someone would go through Victoria's stuff but not take any of the money in the rest of the house. Heck, maybe Andreas found the 100,000 marks that Victoria had stored and decided in rage to burn it along with the rags he used to try to clean up the blood. All of this makes perfect sense to me, and honestly, it's the version of the story I think to be most likely. Except for one little problem. Andreas was also murdered. So how could Andreas have murdered the whole family, and then Andreas himself also be murdered, along with the family? It's almost frustrating how well Andreas murdering the family is as a theory, except for the little detail that he died as well. As a matter of fact, there's one popular theory that after murdering the entire family, then hanging out in the house for a couple days, Andreas slipped and fell onto the mattock and just accidentally cut his face open and then died that way. And I guess decided to crawl through the hay to lie next to Victoria's body. But I think there is someone who may have been likely to murder Andreas, even after the rest of the family was killed. And I think it's someone we've already talked about. Lorenz. What if Andreas murdered his entire family, and then in a panic begins to hide in the attic of the house or bumble his way through the house itself, not sure of what to do, when Lorenz, who was already in an argument, what if Lorenz, in a rage, gashed Andreas across the face and caused him to bleed out? Lorenz would have immediately recognized how the situation looks, because now the murderer is dead and you are holding the murder weapon. So Lorenz simply places the body of Andreas next to Victoria and then throws the mattock handle up into the attic. Mostly it's suspicious, as soon as Lorenz got to the property on April the 4th with his two witnesses, that he quickly pulled out the body of Victoria, seemingly doing this to see if they were alive, but then not doing it to the two Cecilias who were covered up on the other side of the room. Perhaps Lorenz did this so that no evidence that maybe Andreas was laid onto Victoria's body days later could be brought forward. And if Andreas hadn't already done it, maybe Lorenz threw the mattock into the attic to hide after he had killed Andreas. To his deathbed, Lorenz would state that he was not responsible for the Hinterkaifeck murders, but maybe he was responsible for one of them. And if that's the case, I see no better cosmic justice for this, that the one who tried to take Victoria away from all of this is the one who avenged her death. But of course, all of that is just my theory. Well, I think it's most likely that Andreas murdered his family. It is just an idea that perhaps Lorenz was the one to kill Andreas. Because if Lorenz didn't, then I have no idea who would have. I mean, maybe you could say that somehow Andreas managed to strike his own face hard enough to cause that injury, but that seems unlikely. Or maybe the whole thing that he fell and tripped and cut up his face to death is true, in which case that would be kind of funny. Regardless of all of this, what we do know is that the six people at the Hinterkaifeck farm lost their lives, most of which tragically, again, aside from Andreas. And I don't know how culpable his wife Cecilia was in all the abuse that happened. I, of course, feel horrible for young Joseph and young Cecilia, children who suffered brutal, brutal deaths and did not deserve and probably couldn't comprehend any of it. And I also feel terrible for Victoria, a girl whose entire life sounds miserable and full of dread, and then to be killed in such a brutal way in her final moments. In 2007, a police academy in Germany did an entire reevaluation of the Hinterkaifeck case using new methods, whatever that means, and said that, for one, because of a lack of evidence, there will probably never be a way to prove what happened at the Hinterkaifeck farm. But that in their investigation, each of the researchers came to the same conclusion on the same suspect. But they would not release that information because they had some surviving descendants. Which is the dumbest cop-out I think I've ever heard. Like, could you... I know they don't know. It's just their guess about it. But to not say what the guess is because you're afraid that their great-grandson or whatever will get harassed for it, who would do that? Like, there's still great-grandchildren of, like, Lee Harvey Oswald or John Wilkes Booth, or I don't know if that guy had kids. Regardless, there are descendants of famous killers, and it's not like they get attacked. Just because you say you all think that this person did it doesn't mean their grandchildren will get... That's the dumbest reason to not release information ever. I hate it here. Okay. Regardless of all of that, I don't think we'll ever know for sure who murdered the family on March the 31st. And it's tragic and terrible, and there's really no good ending to it because we don't know who did it, and there's not closure for the victims that were lost, but hopefully, in some small way, we can remember at least Victoria and her children as people, and as people who certainly didn't deserve what they go to, and hopefully their souls are somewhere more at rest now than they were in this lifetime, except for Andreas. He absolutely deserved what he had coming. And with that, we have the end of what I think is the, if not the most disturbing, one of the most disturbing unsolved cases I've ever come across. I covered this way back when I did the Unsolved True Crime Iceberg, and ever since I first read about it, it has stuck with me and it's been in the back of my head, so I decided to read a book about it to see what else was there, and it's so much worse than I thought, and I feel so bad for Victoria and the family, and her kids, I mean. And yeah, it's a tragedy every way you look at it, but hopefully, you know, I don't know, this is a depressing video. There's no, like, good, you learned this or this came of it or whatever. Everyone's sad and it's awful. Except maybe, you know what? If my interpretation of events is true, then Lorenz seemed to be an all right guy. And if he did murder Andreas, that's really cool of him to do that. But at the same time, I don't want to fully double down there because I'm just a YouTuber and can very well be wrong. And maybe Lorenz was actually the murderer because people smarter than me seem to think he is sometimes, and some other people think it's Andreas. I don't know. It's complicated. I'm going to stop talking. As gruesome as this story was, hopefully you enjoyed it. And I just want to say thank you for watching. I always feel weird covering these stories because, especially when we don't know anything for sure, I have to be careful about giving too much praise to one person or not enough to another. Again, I don't think Lorenz did it. I think Andreas did it. But I have to be careful because I can always be wrong, right? But yeah, this is a very depressing story, but it's something that stuck with me. And if something sticks with me for too long, I have to make a video about it or it just gets stuck in here and it's not good for my health. So this was that. And as depressing and terrible as it was, hopefully you enjoyed, hopefully you learned something, even if you had heard of this case before, and I greatly appreciate that. Thank you all for the support. Thank you so much for the views, the likes, the contributions. It means the world. You guys are great. I believe that should do it for now, but I just want to say thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you in the next one. Bye!